You're listening to The Inquiry on the BBC World Service with me, Kavita Puri. Each week, one question, four expert witnesses, and an answer. It's late in the evening in downtown Rio de Janeiro. A notorious gang member throws a bottle into a moving car. The driver gets out. A fight starts. Others join in. Petrol bombs start being hurled. The situation quickly escalates. In Rio's command centre, a camera spots them. Operators in crisp white jumpsuits watch the scene unfold. In front of them is a giant wall monitor broken into a grid of status graphs, meteorological reports and live video feeds from traffic and surveillance cameras. The gang are located. The nearest police units are sent to the scene of the crime. The fire brigade are on their way to put out the fires. Transport authorities reroute the buses. Traffic systems are alerted. This is all done in a matter of minutes. This is not some futuristic vision. Rio now has the world's most integrated urban command centre. All of the city's 30 departments can be seen in one single monitoring room. It's just one way a smart city can look, using tech to make our cities more connected, livable, healthier, and even greener. Is this a bright future, or with 24-hour surveillance, a science fiction nightmare? This week we ask, are smart cities dumb?
Part 1. The future is now.
It's called The Crystal, and it's in the east end of London. It's an all-glass building, which is pretty iconic.
This is Mark Jenkinson. He's head of cities at Siemens. He's describing the place he works.
There are 3,500 data points around the building, sensors, so we can actually adapt the actual air quality to the number of people in the building.
That's a lot of sensors. The building is like a smart city in miniature. It uses data to change the office environment to best suit the people inside. And by adjusting the air quality, temperature or lighting, the building is sustainable too, energy efficient and with hugely reduced greenhouse gas emissions.
So I guess if you imagine a perfect place to live or work, that's the crystal for you.
Mark Jenkinson lives in London, a city that uses technologies which make it smart. Take one example, his journey to work. He uses an Oyster card, a smart card, that allows him to travel on any form of public transport. The data collected from the journey tells transport authorities where he's going and when, critical information that planners use to get people to their destinations quickly. And smart cities, he believes, is a way to deal with pressing urban challenges.
The population globally is 7 billion. It's going up to, we believe, 11 billion by 2100. More and more people are still moving to cities. You know, there's going to be more and more strain on our infrastructure, on our transport, on our energy systems, on our buildings. And really the only way we can actually change what we're doing to be able to mitigate or adapt to some of these challenges is to adopt smart, or basically adopt technology.
Smart infrastructure, smart utilities, smart technology, and smart communication are the building blocks of tomorrow. The future is smart, and the future is here.
And it's not just the long-established cities like London, New York, or Madrid that are becoming smart. Some are also being built from scratch. Big tech corporations like Google's spin-off company Sidewalk, IBM and Siemens are selling packages from across the world, from Chennai to Lagos, where the new smart city Eco-Atlantic is being built, promising a new urban future.
All right, guys, welcome to Eco-Atlantic! need.
The idea was, how do we reclaim all the land lost over the past 100 years due to coastal erosion, make a full long-term protection, and eventually become a business center for West Africa and eventually Africa.
Smart cities are now on the front line of tackling climate change and experimenting with new energy-efficient innovations.
Got a nice example in Brooklyn. It's called the Brooklyn Microgrid. The various residents have solar PV on the roofs, so if they're generating more than they need, they can actually sell it to their neighbour.
And that's working, is it?
That's working, yeah. So,
and how many residents is that?
I think there are about 20 for? Involved mm-hmm. So far. But
this and is why not on a bigger scale?
There's no reason why you couldn't do. And I think that's one thing about the opportunity for these smart city projects. So you could scale up to the wider city district or the city. So the idea is what we do here in London, we could possibly share with Lisbon and Milan.
And in this new smart world, all you need is an internet connection and the know-how. And you can do that in any place in the world. And for developing countries, he believes, this could offer huge opportunities.
If they can become kind of the hotbeds of expertise, they could become world leaders and create a new focal point for the industry of the future.
So developing nations could be in a strong position to be at the forefront of this new data-driven world.
Part 2, Leapfrog.
Africans used to travel long distances to perform fairly simple tasks, such as just to complete the sale of goods and services. We used to travel hundreds of miles just to make a payment, simple things like that.
This is Yao Awusu from Accra, Ghana.
We don't do that anymore because there are homegrown innovations that are changing the way business is done.
He's founded a company to manage the country's first technology park. He hopes it will start a smart city revolution in West Africa. When it's built, it'll have super-fast broadband and a modern infrastructure. Already, big-name tech companies from around the world have signed up to the hub, which will come up with smart innovations for smart cities.
In these developing regions, such as Lagos, Nigeria, Mexico City, Caracas, Venezuela. And these cities are not as well structured as, say, London, Hong Kong, New York. And they do not have access to, modern inventions as these old, better developed cities do. And so what is happening is that smart city innovations are helping to leapfrog the development that until recently was sort of limited to people in developed countries.
One significant way they can leapfrog, he says, is because developing countries don't need to deal with pre-existing infrastructure. So in the case of telecoms, for example, they can go straight to super-fast 5G mobile technology. It's a blank canvas. The new cities can learn from the mistakes of older ones, and innovation is already happening. Take Energy and M-Kopa, which was pioneered in East Africa. It's provided renewable electricity to hundreds of thousands of homes.
They're now waiting for the government to lay down the national grid as they used to, So what they do is they install a small solar panel.
There's also a special mobile handset connected to the solar panel.
It's very affordable. You pay $2, a month. And then you own the solar panel.
And so that could be used in any kind of smart city.
That is correct.
After around 2 years, the solar panel's been paid off. These handsets that run off solar panels are aimed at a particular urban group.
So this is basically targeted at the disenfranchised, obviously includes slum communities such as Kibera, in Nairobi, and Nima in Ghana. And of course, in Lagos, they also have huge communities that are basically slum communities, yes.
Innovations like giving poorer people access to a mobile or smartphone, he says, opens up a whole new world. Doesn't that sound smart?
Part 3. Paradise Lost?
We shouldn't think about smart cities per se, because when you actually translate smart in an Indian language, it's either chatur or chalu, and it has a negative connotation. It's about being opportunist, it's about being Machiavellian, taking advantage at the cost of others.
This is Ayuna Dutta. She grew up in New Delhi and is now an expert in sustainable cities and urban futures.
And the suggestion was that we shouldn't be using the word smart. We should be calling ourselves intelligent, because we take intelligent, well-informed decisions that are democratic, that enable freedom and empowerment, particularly of those communities that have been left out.
So intelligent rather than smart cities was the feedback from Ayuna Dutta's fieldwork with citizen groups in India. There, the government of Prime Minister Modi proclaimed the ambition that the country would have 100 smart cities. And some of these will be brand new cities with state-of-the-art technology, monitoring and controlling every part of life.
The key feature is that there would be some kind of technology use. In some cities, it's been really benign in the sense of just a new app. And in other cities, there are command and control centres, where all the systems can be seen together. And you have these big screens showing all the systems, the weather systems, the CCTV cameras across the city, the traffic systems and so on.
That's the official vision of a smart city. The unofficial one, she says, based on talking to citizens groups and activists, is that the smart city doesn't capture what Indian cities are about and what they should be in the future.
Technology is not the solution. It is a medium, but it's not a panacea to all sorts of problems.
In fact, Ayuna Dutta says, technology can make existing problems and inequalities even worse. Chandigarh, in the province of Punjab, was one of the first smart cities that she studied. One of the interventions proposed
was called Kramat, which was a citizen monitoring app. And basically what it means is if you see that your rubbish has not been collected, then you can actually take a picture of the rubbish, or it can take a picture of the sweeper and put it up through the app onto the city portal. And it immediately goes to the concerned department and it's immediately dealt with, because the department can then see which sweeper has not been doing their work properly.
But, she says, the street sweepers weren't happy at being singled out. They came from low-income communities, often lower caste, and they mostly had informal contracts and rarely had any safety equipment. So they went on strike.
So what the technology really did is that when you don't clean up middle-class colonies, it gives control to middle-class citizens to then tell the city of who is not doing their role. But the subject of that surveillance are the people at the lowest end of the social and employment hierarchy. So it actually reinforced some of the existing inequalities.
And Ayuna Dutta says it gets even worse. She says for some smart cities, slums were not part of a modern, futuristic vision.
Often these visions of urban future is that we'll have a very technology-enabled smart city, very resource-efficient, and therefore it would also be slum-free. And some cities have taken slum-free very literally to remove slums in order to create the smart city. And in fact, it wasn't in some cases, even the moment these cities were announced as one of the 100 smart cities, they began slum clearance schemes, because how could you be smart if you had slums there?
And for those who were not moved on,
the smart city gives this promise of the future, a promise of an equal space of the city in the future. But it's only if you are also a smart citizen. It's only if you have access to those smartphones. It's only if you have access to the smart safety apps. It's only if you know how to use the bike sharing scheme, for example. And that automatically relies upon a particular kind of citizen who's well-educated, who has a good digital capacity, who has access to good technology.
So what you're saying, a smart city is really for the middle class?
Often, yes. Yes, it is. What remains to be seen in India, though, having said all that, is most of these smart city initiatives are not completed. So we just have to wait and see what really happens. But the start of these schemes, in the ways that they have begun to roll out, has raised alarm bells.
alarm bells for those groups concerned with freedom of choice, democracy and equal access. Are smart cities dumb? Who wants to be labelled a dumb city, she says. It's hard to resist being part of a modern, high-tech area. It means it's achieved a new kind of urban future. But better to reframe the term smart, she believes, so that it's also inclusive and empowers all citizens.
Part 4. Livable.
The smartest city is one that offers opportunities to all its residents and gives them access to the city in the same way.
Elissa Walker is the urbanism editor at Curbed magazine in Los Angeles.
But unless it's livable, equitable, and accessible, it's still dumb.
She prefers the term livable city rather than smart, and a livable city may use tech, but that's not always the case.
These companies really want everybody to take advantage of the solutions that they're deploying, whether it's through a smartphone or maybe a kiosk on the side of the street. It doesn't always touch everybody in the same way. And when you go back to think about how we can fix things in cities or create solutions that actually have impact, it's not usually going to happen for everybody through a smartphone.
One way she wants to fix cities is for them to be designed in a way that isn't just for what she calls an able-bodied, middle-aged man. It should be for families too, as well as an aging population. This isn't about accessibility to technology. It's about being able to physically get around your own city. Part of that is
transit and transportation is a good place to start. Just for example, in Los Angeles, we're talking about making transit free for everybody as part of a bigger solution for the city that will deploy around the time of the Olympic Games in 2028.
LA plans to charge people extra who drive in rush hour or in busier parts of the city center. It also wants to slap tariffs on taxi ride sharing companies who don't pay tax right now. And all that money would be reinvested into
dedicated cycleways, wider sidewalks, more street trees. And eventually we could make public transit, bus, trains, bike share, scooter share, whatever is next share, could all be free. And that would truly become a life-changing thing for most people who live in a city.
Life-changing indeed. But she has worries with all the talk of smart cities that the very basics of city life is getting left behind.
Cracked sidewalks. We have an enormous amount of our city where you can't even navigate if you were using a wheelchair or, as I'm often doing, pushing a stroller. There are parts of our city that where the streets are 8 lanes wide for cars and only a very small, narrow sidewalk. We have a tree canopy that has been dying for the last decade because the city has not devoted enough funds to maintaining it. So these are very basic quality of life, but also environmental concerns.
But hearing that, really basic things that you're talking about LA, kind of seems ridiculous that we're talking about smart cities and data if you've got cracked sidewalks.
Totally. I mean, that's the biggest argument. But you could say that technology could help you locate where those cracked sidewalks are if you got an army of people across the city to go out and report them and recommend changes. If you had some kind of tool where you could use satellite imagery of streets to find out which trees were dead or needed to be replanted. So there's a lot of ways that we could have tech help us. But in the end, the solution is going to be, you know, repairing concrete, digging in the ground, making sure our curbs are appropriately resculpted so people of any ability can use them.
So tech can help locate the broken pavement or the overhanging tree and even assist reporting. But ultimately, it's a non-tech solution that will fix it. She says citizens need to be asked what kind of city they want to live in. Solutions shouldn't be top-down, whether from governments or tech corporations. the most common refrain she hears in community meetings is,
"We didn't ask for this," right? So I think especially when you have a solution come down from some city government or city leader or city department, that they've come to your neighborhood and decided what's best for you. I do think technology can offer a pretty good platform, at least, but for that community engagement, for getting input from people to ask them what they want and to let them describe and share their ideas for what they want.
And of course, as cities move towards becoming smart, using a vast network of sensors amounting to millions of electronic ears, eyes, and noses, it's corporations rather than the elected authorities who have our data.
If you have a smartphone, your location is being tracked, your data is being tracked. All these things are already happening to you. People are worried about data collection in cities with things like cameras and sensors. There's a lot of that stuff that's already going on, and you probably don't even know anything about it.
She thinks city governments should take action against tech companies to ensure they don't have unlimited power.
You have to make them sign a contract with you that so you get the data that you want and you're able to give them the data that they need to have.
So are smart cities dumb? Cities are complex places, often bursting at the seams as populations congregate towards them. What can be wrong with making them more efficient, healthier, greener using technology? Cities have always changed with the times. Maybe smart cities will be a spur for progress. But the worry is that it's a vision of unaccountable corporations who'll have even more access to our data. And for those on the fringes of society without access to the technology, with housing that's not part of this futuristic vision, divisions may widen. And then smart cities no longer look so smart anymore. The Inquiry was presented by me, Kavita Puri, and produced by Jordan Dunbar. The researcher was Bethan Head. It was mixed by Rod Farker and edited by Emma Rippon. Our production coordinator is Eleanor Newton. And if you like this episode, please do leave us a rating or a comment wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Kim Chakanetsa, and I'm the host of the Conversation podcast from the BBC World Service. To celebrate International Women's Day, I want to tell you about our show. The Conversation brings together two women to talk about something they have in common. It could be a passion, a profession, or even a shared experience. We have an incredible array of guests, everyone from beatboxers to professional boxers, Olympic gymnasts to Nobel Prize-winning scientists.
A lot of times women sort of get lumped together, like we're just all one thing and we all think alike. And of course, we can't all have had the same experiences and we can't all think alike.
And we're also taking it on the road. We're going to all these different countries to hear from the women living in those countries about what it means to them to be a woman there today.
Being a woman in Ireland means I can move around freely, but I still can't avoid sexual harassment.
Being a woman in Pakistan means I'm covering my head, not my brain.
Extraordinary conversations with extraordinary women and a really good listen for everyone. Search for The Conversation wherever you found this podcast.